Welcome to Topple Uncaged. I'm Steve Topple and you're locked on to the UK's hottest politics and music podcast. Each week, I bring you the rawest takes on the big stories making the news, always joined by a very special guest. Then, I pleasure your mind, body and soul with the freshest, most banging international music going.
Uncaged.
Because there's a major demand for low-key material. Do you think we're going to get more low-key material in 2016?
I don't know about in 2016, but I would find it hard to believe that never in his life is there someone naturally that talented, that brilliant an MC, with music just flowing through his veins. I would be very surprised if he never ever comes back.
Low-key's one of them people, and like his energy was right. Certain people's energies are off, and I just think we're on a different side spiritually. On a deeper thing, I just feel like you're on the other side spiritually. We can work.
You could never top my fire in a booth. I don't need a label, I'm saying to the truth.
There is only one album that has had nearly 750,000 streams on Spotify in less than 2 weeks since it was released. There is only one album that could feature the political mastermind that is Noam Chomsky and incorporate him into a smorgasbord of hip-hop, neo-soul, grime and trap-slash-drill. There is only one album that could do this while being released by a truly independent record label. And there is only one album which could serve not only as a history lesson as to how we got to this point, but also as an overarching narrative about what we need to do now we're here. There is only one album that could do all this, and there is only one artist who could be the driving force behind it.
Bursting, worst than my type, champion night nursing. 016 did a sold out tour. Think you know my life, I don't know about yours. I was blackballed then because I spoke about war. They want me closed down, but I spoke out more. Now the silence is broken.
That album is, of course, Soundtrack to the Struggle 2. And the artist is the incomparable Loki, who joins me again on the podcast. Loki, thank you so much for taking time out to join. It's a real privilege, humbling treat to have you back on the game.
No, thank you so much. That introduction, I think you actually surpassed yourself. The introduction you gave me last time was amazing, but this one is out of this world. Thank you so much, bro.
It's my radio and broadcasting presentation, Loki. I actually talk like this in real life. I'm from Suffolk.
Wow.
Look, I mean, I'm not. It's very hard to know where to begin with this album. As I said, it's had 750,000 streams nearly on Spotify, and we are recording on Monday, the 15th of April. So God knows where it will be by 2 weeks in. I mean, it's a masterclass, firstly, in conscious, politically and socially driven music. I mean, I'll get into the finer details later on that. But first off, the tour. You're now one, two, three. Your fourth show tonight, and tickets are selling like literal hotcakes. What's the reception been like? And secondly, more importantly, what's it like to present the album and the project live for the first time since recording it?
Well, basically, we're in Huddersfield today. We have been so far in Manchester, in Newcastle, in Glasgow, in Edinburgh, and it's been amazing. I think the best part of it is meeting people from different places, from many different walks of life, who have in some way been moved by the music enough to spend their hard-earned money to come to your gig. You know, in some cases, like last night, we were in Manchester. It was a Sunday. You know, people waiting outside in the cold, and we, you know, at the end of every show, I tried to do a meet and greet. You know, on this tour, every single day was doing a meet and greet, but generally I tried to do a meet and greet and meeting people who are telling you, you know, somebody, for instance, last night said to me that 2 years ago, she was, in her words, these were her words, she said she was a racist. Mm. And she said that listening to my music helped her in that process from moving from being like that to actually seeing people as equal and having empathy for other people. And she said she's going to be going to Palestine in a few months and hoping to go to Gaza. Her and her partner were there. Mm. And that's amazing, because you think if your music can at least be seen as not necessarily a catalyst, but having some role in that transformation in a person or that development of that person, or kind of cultivating appreciation of other people's humanity, that's a really, really amazing function. So, yeah, it's great. In a way, you get to know how the best of how your music is being received. Mm. Because if you were to be the type of person that would spend a lot of time reading, say, YouTube comments, and we do know that there is misinformation farms there, especially when you're dealing with some of the issues that we're dealing with, you may have people on the internet who are actually employed to discredit what it is you're doing.
Yeah.
If you were to rely on kind of reading YouTube comments, sometimes you could feel a little bit disheartened about what you're doing. We do, of course, know, as has been at length kind of revealed by people, whether it's Nafiz Ahmed or Max Bluth or others, the way that social media companies are also susceptible to manipulation, whether it's de-emphasizing certain pages or it's kind of messing with the views. But, you know, in terms of being able to do an 18-city tour, and we have, you know, between 4,500 to 5,000 tickets bought altogether, it's really a big achievement. And I think it's something that the team that I've been able to assemble, you know, we've been working together, have done a really good job in kind of working in a kind of well-oiled way to make sure everything runs to plan. And we're able to kind of maximize the interactive part of the tour as well. So, yeah, it's great. It's a blessing, man. It's definitely a blessing. And it wouldn't have been possible 2 decades ago. You know, somebody with these kind of messages would have been blocked by the gatekeepers. You know, at that time, if you weren't on Tim Westwood Radio 1, you didn't really count. If a major label didn't back your cause, you weren't really going to be anywhere. I think probably about a decade ago, independents started being able to do things with hip-hop artists and stuff like that. So things started to change a decade ago. And also the other amazing thing is that while I am performing a lot of the new tracks from the album, I'm also performing the ones from the album that came out in 2011, and that's almost a decade ago as well.
Mm.
And so you start to see how the messages have changed. I'll be honest with you, Steve, there's some lyrics that are in the songs that I was putting out in 2011 that are cringe now, you know, and I think, well, you kind of have to perform it because it's one of the ones that's more popular, and people know the lyrics to those songs, but I definitely wouldn't have written them the way I wrote them at the time. So all of that kind of is a factor as well.
Mm.
But at the same time, it's brilliant to just have songs that people even know, you know?
Yeah. No, absolutely. The story about the young lady who said 2 years ago she was a racist and then she listened to your music, that is amazing, because ultimately I imagine surely that is what it's all about. I mean, you mentioned how a decade ago, to be honest, I'm tearing up my script already here about what I want to talk about. I'm just ignoring what I've written. You talk about how a decade ago this wouldn't have necessarily been possible because of the way, as you say, the gatekeeper has controlled it. But now, I mean, an artist like yourself, who it's truly independent, has managed to get the support of Grime Daily, and who is, as I said in the introduction, again, is nearly three quarters of a million streams on Spotify, has managed to do this. I mean, is that must be overwhelming for you at times, surely, this level of sort of love and support and solidarity with what you're doing?
Well, I think that I would have had more of a tendency in 2011 to take it in quite an individualistic way. And what that can do is be quite isolating.
Mm.
But now, because I've been able to kind of develop my understanding of the world a bit more, I understand it as having a function in collective struggles and movements, rather than being about this kind of big I am or the career. It's about, okay, that does that. We are able to direct people. You know, we have Stop the War, for instance, at the events, registering people. We have Vice President United with us on this tour, a good friend of mine, who's also kind of directing people in ways that are directly useful. You know, because one of the frustrating things I found before was what I felt sometimes be the limitation of me going up on the stage and making music and singing, but essentially you're just directing people to, you know, it kind of continuing a cycle of consumption. But that's not actually what we're trying to do. We're trying to get people to directly get involved, to cultivate a sense of agency and political participation. Essentially, we're trying to drive open that kind of that sense of political involvement, really.
And
also the other thing, Steve, one other thing that I personally think is good and really good is the fact that in our lifetime, Steve, there's probably no other group of people that have had as much resources dedicated to making people in this country dislike as people that are racialized as Muslims. Mm. So literally, at very least since 2001 to now, there has been, if you were to try and collate the exact amount of money, the exact amount of journalists who have literally made their entire careers off of writing purely slanderous rubbish about Muslims, it would be massive. Now, there's one school of thought, which actually on one part of the album I probably would be more likely to subscribe to, which would have been Children of Diaspora, when I had a slightly more identity politics way of viewing myself. Mm. And almost like identity was this kind of stagnant, non-moving, intransigent thing that exists whether the person likes it or not, or wherever else. That I would have subscribed to this idea that the consensus across the country is one way, and it's dead against people like me speaking the way I speak politically. And that, there's no way that people would ever accept someone speaking in this way. But actually, what you see is, I think, considering the amount of money that has been essentially poured into trying to persuade people in this country to almost launch pogroms against Muslims, and at worst maybe launch an insurgency against a pro-Muslim government, the fact that I am able to tour and meet these people, and the people that are coming to the shows, a vast majority of them are English people. Obviously it differs from place to place, just that's a kind of a crude way of describing it. Mm. But it's a testament to the fact that people do resist, and that actually the lived reality contradicts this clash of civilization narrative that billionaires who don't even pay taxes here want us to see the world in. They want us to see the world in this perennial struggle between dead set enemies.
Yeah.
And the fact that my music is embraced to the extent that it is, with as little support as it gets from, the 1% who are represented by the major record labels, it's a great thing. It actually says something really interesting about the society at this time.
I think it does,
probably won't be historicized as such, though. It probably wouldn't be historicized as such, but it says something interesting,
Absolutely. No, you're right. And that will, of course, be erased from the sort of establishment corporate history books. But no, it does. The 750,000 people. To start with, just on Spotify alone, I think it does say something. I think it says something quite fascinating, maybe as well, about the almost polarization between people who are conscious now and how much more conscious they maybe are in 2019. I think, because there is so much access now to be able to make yourself sort of politically and socially and morally ultimately aware. I think you're right. I think it is very telling, and we'll get onto the sort of the content of Soundtrack of the Struggle to a bit later, because I want to go in a bit more detail on that. But I want to talk about the music as it is, as in music of the album. I did, Loki, was I took Soundtrack to the Struggle brackets one, we'll call it Soundtrack to the Struggle one, which was released in 2011, and I listened to it back to back with Soundtrack to the Struggle two, because I wanted to compare them both for numerous reasons, not least to sort of try and work out where you were in 2011 and then where you are now in 2019. Now, musically, I was quite interested, because it kind of stood out for me somewhat that while the production and the arrangement musically has become a lot slicker, that's obvious to tell. What hasn't changed, your kind of the musical influences and the style almost hasn't really moved that much from 2011. I know people call you a hip hop artist, and it's all your music music is grounded in hip hop, you've got that sort of constant sort of boombox kind of drums going on in the background on a lot of the tracks. But I think also you move into a lot of the time sort of neo soul territory. There's on the latest release, the death of neoliberalism is brilliant. It's kind of like this 70s soul throwback with these great vocals from Greg Blackman. I mean, it's absolutely fantastic track.
Teresa's a terrorist, we could be standing at the precipice of freedom. Pontificate, philosophize.
Well, what you've done on Soundtrack to the Struggle 2 is you've incorporated elements of grime, but also noticeably on some of the tracks, sort of more trap and drill elements, which brings it bang up to date. Now, It's a fascinating sort of, as I said in the introduction, smorgasbord, because then what you've done as well, you sort of dropped in Mr. Chomsky there along the way. And I mean, it looks, for me, as looking from the outside in, you've made an incredibly accessible album, which most importantly is musically relevant to as we'd say around where I live, the youngers, and extremely accessible to them, but then with this extremely pertinent and important political narrative that goes alongside it. I mean, was that sort of up there at the top of what you wanted to achieve with Soundtrack to Struggle 2, was to make something that was accessible, especially to the younger generation?
Well, I think that inevitably the subject matter has become a little bit more dense and a little bit more sophisticated than the first one, because it just wasn't, my understanding wasn't that deep. It was quite superficial before. So I think it increased in that way. In terms of making it accessible to people, I do think that was, and we kind of touched on it in the last interview, it was to some extent a conscious decision to say, okay, well, in some cases, you have been able, I looked at the things that have been successful before that I've done, and I've thought, okay, well, they presented something high on style, but not necessarily high on substance. And so if it was down to me, in all honesty, tracks like Return of Loki or the Goat Flow song probably wouldn't have been included on the album, because that's not, they don't mean that much to me in a sentimental sense. I don't feel that those are songs that are necessarily going to change anyone's life. Stylistically, they might sound more impressive to people that I think I would want to hear the other stuff. So in a way, it's kind of like those songs act as a vehicle to introduce the listener to the more dense stuff. You know, once you have Noam Chomsky talking about J.P. Morgan, but if you're just having that, unfortunately, also you have to take into account Spotify playlists now. You know, that has really, not irrevocably, but it's really significantly changed music. You know, if you have an album that doesn't have anything on a playlist, then it's going to decrease the amount of streams you get and the amount of people that listen to your music by several hundred thousand at least. Whereas if you've got songs like Return of Loki and The Goat Flow, they have been playlisted on Spotify, and really that's been hugely responsible for the amount of streams, because then that means that people are being directed towards the album, and the algorithms are the way they are. You know, normally Palestine 3, as accessible as it sounds sonically in some ways, you know, Maverick Saber is amazing, really beautiful, beautiful vocals. It's very unlikely to get playlisted. It's never been played on any radio station that I know of. I mean, actually, Long Live Palestine 1, I think, got played by Meme Shake on BBC Asian Network. But you know, that's one kind of side of it. But essentially, yeah, those tracks hopefully will serve as vehicles to amplify the rest of the album, really.
No, and we did discuss this previously, before you released Soundtrack to the Struggle 2, before I'd even heard it, and I think it is very important, and I concede that as an artist, for you, and I understand because I'm musically trained, that as an artist, The Return of Loki and Goat Flow is probably not necessarily what you want to be doing, but as you quite rightly point out, they are vehicles to draw people in. I mean, what they're also vehicles for, and I have to say it, because while you are a conscious, sort of morally, politically and socially motivated individual and artist, you're still a damn fine rapper, Loki, and I have to talk about that. I have to talk about this because, I mean, vocally throughout the album, you're off the hook. I mean, compared to when you compare Soundtrack to the Struggle 1 to the latest release number 2, the rhyming patterns within your rapping are more complex, the pitch levels that you are rapping at are more diverse, and especially Goat Flow.
Your lackadaisical tax tame, your full rap selects will fall back. Bat your basics, don't snap your frame for talk back to change all the facts. Man, the capable tracks available, stats are paid for full that. Perhaps the labels will rap your way to court, platinum chain, your ball snatch.
I mean, do you know what I did? I'm a bit of a geek. I sat there and sort of crunched some numbers, and I worked out that at one point during Goat Flow, you're rapping at 10 syllables a second.
Wow.
That's what you're doing. Did you not realise? That's like really...
That's mad.
Yeah, it's 10 syllables. There's one section where you do... Let me count it back in my head. 1, 2, 3. There's one section where you do 4 lines and you do the same rhyming pattern twice, and that works out 10 syllables a second. And, like, I remember back in the day when Twista was in the Guinness World Book of World Records for doing 11.4 syllables a second. So it's pretty damn quick, Loki.
Wow.
And this
that
is an
amazing bit of information. Thank you.
Now you
that
know.
Is wicked.
So,
that is wicked.
I mean, you are. And I think when you're a conscious artist like yourself, it can be almost forgotten that you're actually extremely, extremely talented, both vocally and musically as well, of course, because, as I said before, musically is an extremely stunning piece of work. What I also noticed between Soundtrack to the Struggle 1 and the new release 2 was, I mean, sort of your vocal style almost... Soundtrack to Struggle 1, it was very angry, and rightly so, it was very angry. I mean, we were in 2011, you were 24, I believe, when you wrote it.
Yeah, right.
And sort of at that age, and with everything that was going on in 2011, sort of political movements weren't as defined necessarily as they are now. You came across very angry, and as I say, rightly so. What I see in number 2 is that there's been a maturing of your voice. Your voice has more authority to it now as well. Not authority in a bad way, but as in confidence within what you're saying. And your messages and the way you deliver them vocally are more poised, I suppose. And it comes across, as I say, there's more authority and there's more poisonous and more sort of, it's more contemplating, and there's a real difference in the way you deliver your vocals. I mean, do you think is that a sort of sum of various parts? Like, for example, you've become a father now, what you've learned since 2011, the sort of natural changes that happen to us as humans when we age. Has things changed like that for you to sort of bring you to this more sort of, as I say, more confidence and a more poised vocal almost, and this angry kind of raw Loki that we saw on the first album in 2011?
Well, what I would say is I wish that at least 50% of the interviews I did were with someone that actually thought as deeply about the music as you do.
That's very kind.
Many interviews with people that definitely have not listened. They probably have not listened to one song on the album, let alone, you know, thought about it in that way. So I appreciate that, man. In terms of the difference between them, I definitely think that being at a time where I had not formed coherence in terms of the way I believed society should be, and so there's a bit more coherence about that, and also I hadn't understood the arcs of history. I just hadn't read, really. I was instinctively rebelling against several things, but I hadn't done the reading which would allow me to understand the way we got to the point we were at then. I understood why things were bad, but I didn't understand the foundation of those things. I didn't really understand the ideological basis for a lot of those things. There were limitations. There was youth. There was, again, you know, what you saw through the years which preceded the album were people bumping up against the kind of totalitarian aspects of power. So, you know, these things were just off the table to vote about. And, you you know, I think we spoke about the inverted totalitarianism Sheldon Wallen stuff before, but we were bumping up against it in many ways, whether it was the student demos against the rising tuition fees, whether it was the Israeli Operation Castle in Gaza, and seeing the way that young men, not that different from me in the area I lived in, had been criminalized because of their participation in it and had really been left by the wayside in a way. If we talk about demobilization of young, you know, this depoliticization of young men racialized as Muslims in this society, we can't discount that protest movement against Operation Castle, because it was during that time that they were being attacked by the police, literally. And then when protecting themselves, they were not only arrested roughly, not only slandered in the media, they were also disproportionately sentenced. And so Prevent and all of these things have acted in concert to kind of demobilize people. So that doesn't lend itself to a person necessarily having a sophisticated understanding of the politics, because the situation is such is that of such blatant position. It's not a situation where you start to see your ideas even reflected in political discourse. And so in a way, I do believe that you can link the increased coherence maybe in the second album to the political context as of us, you know, having ideas which are about the redistribution of political and economic power, entering the, you know, even in a limited way, entering the public sphere. And so that starts to give you something more to bounce off and to build off. You start to actually feel less insane. And I'm sorry to use kind of such a, it's probably the wrong phrase, start to feel less, you start to feel less abnormal.
Yeah.
Because in a way, when you're ranting and raving about what Israel is doing in Gaza and then being beaten up and then disproportionately sentenced by the police, you are rendered outside of the reasonable, just by definition. Whereas when you start to see, you know, movements that we've seen in the past few years and we've worked for in different ways, we see the kind of discourse put to, in fact, a more reasonable place.
Yeah.
And so obviously that would then lead the music to be a little bit more composed, really, in the way that I'm kind of presenting my argument. But yeah, I just generally think also reading, just being able to really study quite seriously, just has allowed me probably to speak with more authority, definitely to have more conviction in a comfortable way, not just in a kind of sense of moral outrage, not in the sense of like, this is wrong, so therefore it should be different. It's a kind of, okay, I have some understanding of the logic which underlies the way things are and the unjust social arrangements which exist. I understand a bit more about that logic, but I'm presenting a different logic. And so I think that's probably why the second album is the way it is.
I think so, and I think your response to the question shows how that, as you say, the learning, not least, that you've done, but also your development as a human being has grown, because a lot of people would maybe not have that depth of thought as to why their music and their lyricism had changed in that way. So no, I think you summed that up brilliant, and it's the whole. The whole content of Soundtrack to the Struggle 2, it's more considered, if you like. Soundtrack to the Struggle 1, it's very sort of raw, very untempered. And yet what's interesting is the themes that you discuss are still broadly similar. I mean, like, for example, you talk about neoliberalism a lot. While you didn't in Soundtrack to the Struggle 1, it wasn't so obvious that was what you were talking about. So in Soundtrack to the Struggle 2, you call out neoliberalism a lot as obviously one of the roots of all our problems. But what is also shown on number 2 is that, yeah, we can see your learning. I mean, another standout track for me was Letter to the 1%, which effectively is a bloody history lesson. I mean, it's absolutely fantastic.
He's like, you want for cool power to enter. Bahari and his rebellions. They killed his brother Jafar and he cursed the rotten Temptians. Enlightened despots pursuing tactics Machiavellian. Chinese steel.
It's brilliant the way you break it down. And as a listener, what you come away feeling from Letter to the 1% is, shit, we've been here a lot of times before, haven't we? And we keep making these same mistakes. And it's fascinating what the context that you put onto that track and within the track, what it does to you as a listener when you're orally observing it. And it's just, as I say, it's absolutely fantastic. I mean, there was sort of a phrase that came to my head to sum it up for me, the difference between the two albums, and sort of Soundtrack to the Struggle 1 was like you saying really to the world, you need to be angry. And Soundtrack to the Struggle 2 is saying, you need to be angry, this is why you need to be angry, and this is what we need to be doing about it. And I think that's what you've achieved with the album. I want to sort of focus on a couple of specifics now within the project. Children of Diaspora, that was, for me, one of the strongest tracks. Not least because it was fascinating.
Anthony Walker never had a weapon, but they still got him. Stephen Lawrence never had a weapon, but they still got him. Mark Duggan never had a weapon, but they still shot him. They call him First World Diaspora Problems.
Essentially what you've done, you've taken this, the concept of Diaspora, and kind of flipped it into a much broader narrative surrounding the history of colonialism and imperialism and the very real world effects that are still being felt from that today. That's kind of what hit home for me. And I mean, you can flick open any newspaper in the past week and you can see it now. I don't know if you saw Stormzy accusing people at Festival in Austria of racially profiling his team, to the current epidemic, as it's being called, of knife crime. I mean, for me, what was standout about Children of Diaspora was, again, its historical context, but you took historical situations and historical overarching events and put them again bang up to date in terms of what has happened in recent history. I mean, when you look at the sort of narrative surrounding ethnicity in sort of 21st century Britain and what we're being told are the causes of things like knife crime and what happened to Stormzy again, I know what I think that is, but do you think the historical context of colonialism and imperialism that is still very relevant today, do you think that narrative is somewhat lost in 2019, and do you think it needs bringing to the fore more than it is, or is it back, do you think we're going back to what you touched on earlier about it, maybe it's too much identity politics? I'm interested in your thoughts on that.
Yeah, I mean, I think I wouldn't have written that track the same way I wrote it now, because in a way I'm trying to pin a kind of solidarity between Zaha Hadid and Edward Said and Alton Sterling and Emmett Till. And I think that it's not to say that they're not commonalities, but you can't compare someone like Zaha Hadid, who was a globally celebrated architect, or Edward Said, who studied at Princeton and was named after Prince Edward and went to Victoria College, which is named after Queen Victoria in Egypt. You can't very easily put them in the same position as people that, say, are trying to get into Britain and now are kind of languishing in the camp in Calais, which is named the jungle. They're related, but they're distant relations. Mm. And I think that in that song I was kind of subscribing to quite it was unfortunate, really, I think, that I put it that way. But I still included it because I think there was some things of worth in that song to kind of point out. I do think that generally, because study of the British Empire is not curriculumized in this country, that things like imperialism and colonialism, not only in the present, Derek Gregory has, in his book, The Colonial Present, kind of outlines the way in which there are elements of relationships and arrangements now which are colonial, and that we do have a colonial present. Of course, Ian Cobain kind of pointed out that there has not been a year has not passed since the end of World War One that Britain has not been at war somewhere. you know, he pointed out that at least in the last few years, there's been 7 covert wars waged around the world that have involved the British. Mm. So there is a colonial presence, but not only is that invisibilized now, but also, you know, the simple fact that the end of World War One ended up in further occupation of land, leading to 14 million miles of the world being occupied by Britain. Mm. You know, all of that is invisibilized. So what it means then is that even when people understand, you know, issues like Windrush and the fact that when people came to the country because of the British Nationality Act in 47 or 48, if I remember correctly, all of those people that came from the Commonwealth were British citizens, so they're not immigrants. It's like, whether you have this understanding of Britain had an empire or Britain was an empire, those are two very important ways that determine the way you view other people in this country. If you say that Britain had an empire, then it means those other people that come here relate still in a way of having rather than of being. So if you say that Britain was an empire, then it means that somebody, say, from Sudan, you know, it was believed that Khartoum was originally meant to have been built in the shape of the Union Jack. Kitchener, who was the kind of British general of Sudan, they killed the leader of the resistance and rescued in Sudan his skull and used it as an ink holder on the desk of Kitchener. Yeah. That stuff kind of bears no relevance to the present. You know, a Sudanese person has no right to call themselves British. And I think any Sudanese people in Calais who, you know, were struggling to get to Britain and had first-degree relatives in Britain and stuff like that. So it's about relating to other human beings and the way that you kind of untangle and unravel these things. Mm. Now, unfortunately, we have decades and decades, at very least, if not centuries, of an unspoken elephants in the room that are kind of left and undealt with, you know, and awkward silences.
Yeah.
And I think that a lot more could be done to point out movements like the John Brown's Women's Society in Sheffield, who refused to make the machinery that would keep people in bondage. A lot more could be done to point out, for instance, William Cuffy, you know, the leader of the Chartist movement, who himself was black, and that as part of black history is the gaining of the rights of people that don't own land in this country to vote.
Yeah.
You know, isn't that a really interesting part that should be emphasized? You know, there's a lot more commonality. You know, when you had a situation in Ladbroke Grove that kind of led to Notting Hill Carnival, you had the murder of Kelso Cole Crane, you had 4 days of rioting on Brown Road, the weekend in Grenfell Tower, now where houses of Caribbean people or people that were believed to have come from the Caribbean were being firebombed. What beat that back was resistance, and that wasn't just resistance. You know, so what that means is that while Notting Hill Carnival is kind of a victory march through London for a group of people that were being discriminated against in many different ways, it was something that was beaten back by people in the area joining together and saying, well, actually, this Mosley-supporting, Enoch Powell-supporting lot are not of us. They're not of our community. We have a different type of community that exists. We have a different conviviality and a different hybridity. But these people don't win their absolutes with their ideas of absolute ethnicity, of absolute belonging, of flawless belonging, of purity. They don't actually, they contradict our reality. And so I think that there's something to be said for looking at those groups of people here that did resist during those times. You know, looking at, you know, somebody even like Bertrand Russell, you know, who, you know, we went over it in one of the things we did before about World War One. You know, looking at people that contradicted the kind of trend of power that they may have been born into. I think that's where you can find really interesting stuff, actually.
I think so, yeah. And I think you're being far be it from me to tell you what to think. I think you're being somewhat self-critical of Children of Diaspora, because, I mean, for me, what it does is that, again, back to this sort of overriding feeling I got from the album about accessibility, it would be introducing people who come on to listen to, who heard Goat Flow or heard The Return of Loki, and they'd listen to that track, and at the very least, it would make them consider events that are currently going on around them and sort of why, and giving them some sort of context they may not even understand as yet. So, but I mean, that's just my take on it. And like I say, I think...
No, I appreciate that, definitely, Stephen. I do think there's worth in there, definitely, as a song. But I think it's slightly problematic in that basically it's saying, well, people belong in one place, and therefore they're not being in that place means they don't belong.
Mm.
That's potentially a conclusion that one could draw from the song. And that's not a view I subscribe to now.
Yeah.
You know, at that time, I would have been, you know, it was written around the time of Batman. So there was a kind of feeling that, you know, it was written around a period of time where I was seeing people being treated a certain way, and I was adopting that same belief in absolutes and that same belief in belonging that was the cause of so much of this.
Okay.
And to me, you know, there's been many different groups of people throughout human history that have existed in many different places. You know, you could, when Abu Ja'far al-Mansur first built Baghdad, he brought people from Khorasan, which is now part of Iran.
Mm.
It would have been Persia at that time. Okay, so were you to say those people don't belong here? Why? What makes a person belong in a certain location and another person not belong in a certain location? If it's not this this idea, this very modern idea of the state,
yeah,
you know, and the relationship to that state. So I think you know, it's a problematic song. That's the way I kind of understand it. But you know, it is important to be kind of self-critical in this. In this process.
Of course.
It's all good. It's all good. It serves a purpose, man. And one other thing, you know, I think it was Gary Young, he said, just because the personal is political, it doesn't mean the emotional is empirical. And to some extent, that song lends itself to that kind of emotional is empirical way of thinking. That just because a person feels this way, then that is the clear reflection of the truth. Well, it's not. It's the way a person is. And they're being made to feel that way because of specific circumstances that are imposed upon them, but it doesn't necessarily mean that that is the be-all and end-all of the situation.
No, of course, and
you know?
Yeah, no, absolutely, and I mean that's extremely relevant in many things we have discussed already. So it's fascinating hearing you talk about that, Joe. It's really, really interesting. I want to throw in another question that's just come to me actually. Why did you not put "Refuse to Kill" on the album? I'm quite interested.
"Refuse to Kill." I refuse to make. I refuse to fly.
Yeah, I mean, it's a good question. It wasn't something that I spent a huge amount of time thinking about. I mean, I was commissioned to make that by the Roundhouse, by a good guy called Derek there. And so that song was really, the point of it was to focus on, you know, those figures. Although I did partly feel that it made slightly out of place on the album because it is honing in with a kind of microscope on a specific period of time.
Mm.
You know, even within the kind of festivities of unfortunate festivities, is one way you could kind of describe them, that follow, you know, the kind of centenary stuff, I was speaking in a way that people just weren't necessarily that massively interested in. So then if I'm going to plunk that in the middle of an album where I'm speaking about things that have more significance to people's kind of daily situations, though you could say, of course, Heroes of Human History is another massive reach.
Mm.
You know, I'm trying to get people to start thinking about a polymath that existed in the 900s.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm aware of that. When performing that song, I'm really aware of that, that I'm kind of talking to probably about three people in the room. But it's fine. I mean, it's fine. As long as you're doing that and you're kind of placing that in the mix of a lot of other stuff, then I think it can work. But if the whole album was to be like that, then I think it would definitely be a little bit difficult.
No, absolutely. I was just interested because, I mean, it was Refuse to Kill was a sort of geniusly haunting piece and move by you, and it showed
you, man.
And the I don't want to say it's very hard to describe when someone raps and sings at the same time, apart from calling it what sort of reggae artists call it, which is Sing Jay. But your sort of mixture of rapping and singing, I thought it was beautiful. I was just interested why you didn't include that. I mean, there's lots of other highlights on the album, which I'd love to go into, but otherwise we'd be here for about 3 hours and your audience in Huddersfield wouldn't get to see you. I mean, another standout track for me is Islamophobic Lullabies. Absolutely genius track.
The right kids and blackies are still worrying your dad, but your dad's favorite food is still curry or kebab. The right kids and blackies are still worrying your dad, but your dad's favorite food is still curry or kebab.
Sort of paradox that does actually work. You've taken the sort of hip-hop / R&B track and then you've fused it with this damning message, which is almost like a follow-up to Terrorist, because there's a couple of lines in there when you talk about looking out the window and your dad still eats curry and kebab, and it's kind of like follow-up to Terrorist. It feels like that to me. As I said previously, the death of neoliberalism, it's this brilliant sort of 70s soul influence track with amazing vocals by Greg Blackman and these sharp sort of gospel backing vocals as well. Go on, go and get yourself a tea, coffee, have a toilet break, and join me and Loki back here again in a second. I want to move on and discuss Grenfell, because it's a reoccurring subject throughout Soundtrack to the Struggle 2, one that features prominently and also one that has many implications for a lot of the other subject matter on the album. And obviously, it's a subject that affected you very, very personally. When you wrote... let's just talk about Ghost of Grenfell 2, because it's a stunning track. Ooh, again, like everything is on the album. But it's particularly stunning because aside from the lyricism and the content and the message behind it, musically, it's a beautifully written piece of music as well.
Words cannot express. Please allow me to begin, though. 1:30 a.m. Heard the shouting from my window. People crying in the street, watching the burning of their kinfolk. Grenfell
kind of crosses those boundaries between, you have some hip-hop sensibilities in there, if you like, but you sort of go into neo-soul territory along with the gospel vocals, the gorgeous piano, which is constantly sort of tinkering along on triplets throughout the track. It's beautifully arranged and beautifully written musically. But you wrote it was written, and it talks in terms of it being 12 months since the crime at Grenfell was committed. I mean, when you wrote that and you're reflecting on 12 months, did you think you'd get to nearly 2 years? Because, I mean, it was obviously a 22-month anniversary Sunday just gone, 14th of April. Do you think you'd get to 2 years and still no politicians and no corporations would have properly been held to justice over what happened? Did you think we'd still be where we are now?
Well, I think what has been, in a way, you know, there's a level of inevitability about it, that the state would provide camouflage and continue to guarantee the invisibility of the corporations that caused this, namely Celotex, a subsidiary of Saint-Gobain, a French construction company, and Arconic, a US construction company, who not only puts cladding on the side of buildings that has polyethylene in it that seems to kill people, it also was involved in the building of the F-35 fighter jet with Lockheed Martin and BAE Systems, which has been sold to Israel and sold to Turkey. You know, so there was an extent to which I had felt that this was not going in a direction of serious accountability, but I still find it flabbergasting, really, on a daily basis. The indignity of it all and the disdain with which the bereaved and the survivors and even the local community are being treated by local and by national government as well. And, you know, I think all of this will come out over the years to come. There's really been a concerted campaign to divide people in the community from each other that actually goes all the way up to Theresa May. That's going to be something that's going to come out more and more in future. But in terms of conversation that has been had and the way that they have gone about it, they have constantly sought to pit the community against itself and deflect any type of, you know, in this era of neoliberalism, it's really clear how the state serves as the buffer and the absorbing force for all of people's grievances for rampant corporatism. And that's what really Grenfell essentially is an example of. And Paul Gilroy actually said in a recent interview that he's disappointed, you know, with the exception of John McDonnell referring to it as social murder, he's disappointed actually in you know, a lot of the main figures in Labour for not being able to articulate what happened at Grenfell as an example of something. And I think that because of that failure, because of us allowing, you know, corporate manslaughter with its very, very flawed consequences, were the charge of corporate manslaughter to follow, you know, that would end up with corporations paying fine. That's not what we want. We want people to go to prison for this. And, you know, that entered the lexicon early on because of David Lammy, and it stayed. You know, obviously, I used it in the first track. I probably would change that if I were to write the song again. But, you know, because of that, I think the framework has been defined already by the powerful. And not only do we see a situation where the corporations seemingly regulated themselves, especially if we were talking about Sellotex putting on their website in 2011, Sellotex has now entered government. We are shaping building regulations to maximize benefits to our industry, renting out a bright pink van that went all across the country saying building regulations are changing, going with Sellotex. You know, their technical director, Mark Allen, being an advisor to Sajid Javid on building regulations. We're now in a situation where it's almost as if the corporations are being able to hold themselves accountable. In that, we see a public institution like the Fire Brigade, you know, on a managerial level, there were serious problems with the way that the fire was dealt with that night, undoubtedly. You know, undoubtedly, it cannot be denied. But they were brought through the grinder in the public inquiry very early on. But yet we're being told now that these corporations have, you know, over a year to prepare themselves before they have to face the public inquiry, which is, you know, really ridiculous because there's all types of procedures that they can put into action between now and the inquiry to try and cover their back. So, you know, many ways in which we have seen the government merely provide camouflage for these companies. You know, most of all, in that those companies' names have not become part of the national discussion. Surely, if you were a government that was trying to fulfill your duty as having a duty of care, you know, legally that returns to the government, how is it that you can be so sure that hospitals, schools, cinemas are safe for human habitation, student accommodation? There's a huge amount of people that are affected by this and that are sitting in homes in which the walls are a danger to them because of these companies. And it's truly astonishing, really, on a daily basis, the way the government is also able to mystify the equation and distract people with really, frankly, fairly frivolous things. You know, we have to focus on the issue at hand here, which is that, you know, as I said on the song and as the last song of the album says, you know, neoliberalism kills people. The economic philosophy of our time is something that is quite difficult to pin down. And people sometimes find it hard to say, okay, well, how does this tangibly affect people? Well, here we clearly see when the construction industry is boasting about making the rules which govern it, then who is governing it, and who is protecting our interests and protecting our lives? And it's just completely shocking to see how the macro affects the micro in this way, dire consequences, you know, whether that is to the health of the people that directly live in the shadow of the tower, whether it's to the mental health of people in the area, whether it is, you know, to the fire that entered the building, whether it's to the people who survived it, whether it's the people that even saw it on the TV. Throughout this whole process, those corporations have remained invisible, even to people like us, okay, who are of the political persuasion that we are. I've found myself having spent several times who these companies are.
Yeah.
And I find it astonishing how something could have provided such a massive spectacle to so many people. How, you know, and I remember at the time, one of the things that we'd spoken about was how this mass gathering of people that happened around the tower, people from all over the world that came, it had to be converted into a political movement. Yeah. It had to be, and it wasn't.
Yeah.
It was allowed to turn into a charity case, shall we say, rather than a coherent, clear political movement that was directly calling the names of the companies that did this. Because they lurk in the shadows. You know, that is where they are provided protection, by the shadows. So literally, the more people that say their names possible, the closer we're going to be to any semblance of justice. But again, people often say, what is justice in this situation? Isn't just reparation? Well, my idea, which, you know, many others also have said before and say as well, is building a society where something like that can't happen, where you have the government actually serving as a protector of the people in power, rather than as a servant and handmaiden of the interests of the companies and the people they're supposed to be policing.
No, absolutely. I mean, there's a lot of... Of course, that would be the ideal that came out of this crime, naturally. I mean, there's a few points you made there which I think are crucial. The point about how the corporations involved are essentially in the shadows. I mean, it's a damning indictment of not only our political environments, but also the media and ultimately us as a society, that a name like Carillion, because they went bust, will roll off everyone's tongue very easily. But companies which were, in my opinion, I have to say opinion, obviously, were directly responsible for the deaths of 72 people, most people couldn't name them. I mean, it's a staggering state of affairs when we are at a point like that. And again, I think it's a fascinating commentary you have on Labour's response. It does beg a belief that they weren't more forthright, apart from, as you quite rightly pointed out, John McDonnell with his assertion that it was social murder. But I think what ultimately you touched on, which sums it up so well, is the word corporatist. Because while neoliberal will be the economic doctrine, if you like, of our time, the political machinery is that of corporatist in nature. And the murder of these 72 people at Grenfell was the sort of most horrendous pinnacle in some respects of that blurring of lines between big government and big corporations, and where the companies and profit are allowed to overtly influence the policy-making decisions of our elected representatives. And this is where we ended up. I mean, does it concern you? Because it's a worry for me that we witnessed something like Grenfell. It's been nearly 2 years. And as you pointed out, at the time, the amount of people that influxed in and were present on the ground there, and the sort of hope that it would inspire some sort of change. And as you rightly say, all we're left with is essentially this kind of third sector bandwagon that's rolling along. I mean, does that concern you that if, not to be flippant, but if Grenfell didn't induce the change that we need, what the fuck is going to induce the change we need? Wow. Does it concern you?
I think that's a very good question, and one which asking myself really as we speak, kind of echoing in my head from the question you just asked me. It's really strong. I do think it wasn't so much that the fire itself didn't change it, but the way that we may, but not you, obviously, because you're on the front lines of this war of position, have allowed it to be historicized. You know, I think there is that danger that we haven't been more forthright and assertive in the way that it is historicized. We've allowed it to turn into merely, and it's not to say that it's not, but merely a local scandal. So, yes, it's a local scandal. Yes, it's about RBKC. Yes, it's about the old boys club there. Yes, it's about disdain for the people that live in social housing in North Kensington and, in fact, the people that live in social housing all over the country, of course. But it's actually a national scandal. And potentially, when we look at where these companies operate, you know, God forbid, it could be a global scandal.
Yes.
You know, this Arconic put in their own brochure, 2016, if I remember correctly, that the PE Renobond, this is the stuff with the 6 millimeters of polyethylene, shouldn't go on buildings that are taller than 10 meters. Yeah. Well, Grenfell was taller than 30 meters. So then when asked about how they could put it on Grenfell, they said, well, we behave according to the regulations of the land. You know, and one interesting thing about the changes in building regulations, as has been delved into by amazing work by Inside Housing and Pete Apps, also, bizarrely, an amazing investigative report by Sky News. Yeah, really inexplicably, actually.
Yeah.
That has been the best work that has been done so far in really looking in a forensic way at what happened in Grenfell. You know, it found, well, the Inside Housing stuff found that a lot of the roots of the changes in the building regulations that kind of ambiguized it and allowed it to be interpreted by Philip Hammond, for instance, after the fire, as no, this cladding was illegal, and then interpreted simultaneously by Arconic as no, this cladding was legal, took place, number one, in Heseltine, when they passed the Building Regulations Act in 1984 or 86, between those 2 years. He said it will allow further self-regulation by the industry. It was explicitly stated.
Yeah.
It wasn't something that was kind of hidden. It was something that was clearly said. And then there was, of course, approved document B, which John Prescott was responsible for, which allowed this ambiguity in terms of whether you have to test the surface of PE Renobond, which was aluminium, and therefore would obviously have a different level of flammability from the core, which was polyethylene, which, you know, studies were done that said the equivalent of 30,000 litres of petrol on the side of Grenfell because of the polyethylene. You know, and then you've got the issue of BRE, which is the body that supposedly administers the tests. But again, that has been turned into this weird arrangement where companies test themselves and then report the results of their tests to BRE. So thus allowing that further level of distance and that further kind of autonomy for the... I wouldn't even say autonomy, I'd say kind of self-regulation, shall we say, of the companies. But then also you have desktop studies, which then say if you've got insulation, which was the Celotex insulation, RS5000, and you've got the cladding, which was the PE Renobond, rather than actually testing them together as one structure, as they would be on the building, you test them separately, and then you put the tests that have been reported by the companies. And by the way, bear in mind that Celotex themselves said at the end of last, the end of 2017, that they misdescribed the results on their tests. So they passed the RS5000 as limited combustibility, when in fact it wasn't. And so the point is that they then take those test results, which have been given by the companies themselves. Someone who's not an expert puts them on a desktop and compares them to each other and says, okay, that should fit together fine in the building.
Yeah.
Well, it's just this, in all of these small ways, it's weakened across the board, and then in these small ways, it's weakened more and more and more, which just allows for things to endanger people to take place. completely simple thing for people necessarily to grasp. You know, we're not trained in school to actually understand neoliberalism. It's something that you have to put, you know, you have to independently find a way to think about, you know. And unfortunately, that has meant that people are far more likely to turn the issue into Muslims and social housing in Kensington rather than French and US construction companies burning people. You know, if you were going to look at it in a crude nationalistic way, and even within their own tortured logic of those that subscribe to that way of viewing the world, surely a political elite that allows French and US construction companies to do what seems to have taken place on that day would be traitorous, rather than you focusing on the people that died in that building as somehow guilty of some crime.
No,
you know, it's horrific. I know people, sorry to interrupt you, Steve.
That's right.
You know, I know people that lost family members in there who have never spoken in the media about what happened to their family members. Not in a condemnatory way about the British public, not even in a particularly condemnatory way about the government. But they received near 100 messages of abuse, right? These are people that have done nothing wrong.
Yeah.
They've been accosted on the street and told that their relative deserved to die, you know, along with many other consequences that the person I'm talking about has borne, literally just because of being publicly someone who lost a member of their family. I mean, it's so horrific. It's so horrific. And, you know, the thing is with something like what happened and how dramatic it was and how apocalyptic it was, is it then gives you this kind of hyper-vigilance, because to expect impending doom at any moment is logical. It's logical. You know, you've lived through absolutely disastrous conditions. You would be kind of naive not to then be expecting where's the next disaster going to come from. And so that leaves people with really heightened sense of anxiety. You know, it has been gone into in the media recently that there have been suicide attempts, you know, of people from the local community that I know of. And this is, you know, it's shocking. It's shocking because the state disappears. The state, just this organized state abandonment, you know, that is what happens. And people are really left to their own devices to provide sustenance, to protect themselves, you know, and the state, you know, it's interesting the point you made about Carillion as well, because I think that Carillion didn't show up in the news or become a household name when, you know, Dave Smith and Phil Chamberlain revealed that they were part of this nexus of construction companies that in concert with the intelligence services were spying on people and blacklisting them, as it seems to have been the case that the intelligence services were involved in that process of helping these construction companies blacklist people. So that wasn't enough. And that's an issue of human rights. That's an issue of human rights. We're talking about people that were complaining about toilets overflowing, looking at issues of health and safety, being blacklisted and unable to work. And that blacklisting did result also in suicides. That blacklisting did result in people's families falling apart. That blacklisting did result in really terrible consequences in a nutritional way. And Grenfell is operating in similar ways. You know, I'm seeing the manifestation in people's lives, in the ways they behave, in the ways they deal with problems that they have. You know, and where do you pin the responsibility?
No, absolutely. And I mean, what's in your answer, what you've kind of touched on, which I'll briefly expand on, is, of course, I suppose, why it hasn't seeped into the public psyche. And as you pointed out, why some people are more preoccupied with talking about the fact that the people who were murdered in the tower were Muslims, as opposed to the French and US companies. And then the back to the Carillion issue as well. It's all, for me, Loki, we're back to the sort of psychosocial engineering that neoliberalism and corporatism does. And it it's why it hasn't been kept up the agenda, and why it wasn't the issue which spawned the sort of social revolution we need in this country. Because ultimately what we've had for decades and decades now is this conditioning of the general population via mainstream media, via the systems of employment and work in this country, by the systems of consumerism, that conditions us as a species effectively to see events like Grenfell and kind of either going, oh, that's sad, or oh dear, that's bad that happened, or oh dear, isn't that outrageous, and then move on from it and forget about it. Yeah. Because our daily lives, via consumerism, via finance, via the welfare state, via the health system, via everything that surrounds the neoliberal corporatist machinery, our everyday lives are so consumed sweating the small stuff that we no longer see the wood for the trees. And I think that's for me, that's one of the biggest challenges we face as a species, because it's not a UK problem, it's a global problem, that people are so caught up in the system that they are unable to escape from it just for a minute to see, actually, well, no, we need to change this, and this is what needs to be done. You get so caught up in it that, and we end up at this point where something so horrific can happen, but as you say, people moreover are talking about the fact that the people in the tower are Muslims as opposed to the companies that murdered them in the first place.
Well, I mean, also it's just worth stating as well that Grenfell Action Group on the Save Our Silchester campaign, which preceded the fire and which was on the basis that the Grenfell refurbishment would also entail the demolishing of the rest of Lancaster West Estate and Silchester Estate, which are two estates side by side. That was led by Pierce Thompson, an English white man. Okay. Grenfell Action Group was led by Ed Darfine and Forrest O'Connor. Okay, two white men. Grenfell Residents Association was led by Tim Collins, also a white English man, middle class man.
Yeah.
These people seemingly have been, Grenfell Action Group literally said and predicted what would happen in the fire. Yes. Grenfell Action Group were relentlessly banging on the council's door, ending with Ed being dismissed as a fantasist, literally a fantasist, by Rockfielding Mellon. So it's almost as if those people just are not part of the story anymore.
Mm.
It's almost as if Grenfell becomes some type of appendage of the war on terror. And yet, like you're saying, the social, psychosocial engineering, that's by design. It's by design. Also, the constant constant positioning of the word Grenfell fraudsters next to each other, when by definition it's an oxymoron.
Mm.
If people are defrauding money that's meant for people that survived the fire or residents or local community, then they have nothing to do with the tower. So they're not Grenfell fraudsters.
Yeah.
They're fraudsters who are trying to use that tragedy. But of course, we know that crimes of poverty are punished completely differently to crimes of the powerful. It's two laws.
Mm-hmm.
It's two laws. Let alone crimes of poverty, how about crimes of trauma?
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure if we mentioned it in the last interview, but the gentleman that lives in one of the blocks next to Grenfell, and a body of another man who jumped from the 15th floor. You know who he is. His body was taken and dumped in one of the blocks next to Grenfell. This man, who had a dead body on his front doorstep, took a picture and a video of the body and put it on the internet saying, what the hell is going on? That man was then set up by someone from the media. Someone from the media contacted him and asked to meet him to get the footage. He went to meet them. He was arrested by the police and given 3 months in prison. The Evening Standard, I'll never forget the night of the fire. There's a particular family, six members of the same family died, three generations. At one point, they were on the 21st floor. The wife, and it appears to have been the husband, were waving out of the window to us. We were watching them. We see a helicopter come towards them. We think the helicopter is going to save them or something like that. And bear in mind, people who were in conversation with people inside the building were saying to them, a helicopter is going to come. We can see if they are alert, we can see the helicopters, we can see the plane, they're going to come and get us. Okay, what happened? The helicopter comes within, I don't know, 150, 200 meters of them and turns around. It turns around. And that turnaround and that family were appealing to that helicopter to come and get them, right? That helicopter turned around. Okay, what do I see on the Evening Standard, George Osborne's Evening Standard, within, I don't know, 9 hours of that fire? I see a picture taken from a horizontal view of that family in their dying moments. Yeah? The same newspaper wants to get you up in arms that a bunch of quote-unquote Chinese tourists stopped and took a picture of the tower. Excuse me. There's real sick people in this equation. It's not people that are tourists in the country taking pictures of the tower, to be honest. It's the people that will have the resource to send the fucking helicopter, to send a helicopter up there to take a picture of a people in their dying moments, right? So you can just splash it on your front page. Those are the sickos in this equation. You know, how is it in Bangladesh you actually had helicopters dropping water on the building in Dhaka? How is it that within days you had the owners of the building arrested? And yet up until now, you know, anyone that thinks that this country is some sort of enlightened beacon of human rights is not speaking to the right people.
Yeah.
They're not speaking to the right people. They're not speaking to the people from trade unions that have been blacklisted and have been impoverished by the fact that they're unable to work. They're not talking to people racialized as Muslims who have had habeas corpus completely suspended from them, who've never been found guilty of any crime in court, but yet have been detained indefinitely or have been extradited to the United States without ever seeing the evidence held against them or seeing a judge. They don't understand that people that don't own property in this country didn't even get the right to vote. Have to struggle for 300 years to get the right to vote. And that encompassed totally massive the deporting of William Cuffey. It's just all rubbish, bruv. It's just all rubbish. And I think that, you know, Grenfell needs to serve as an ultimate discreditor of a lot of the mythology that we have about our society.
It does, yeah, and if it doesn't, then we need to be asking serious questions about ourselves, yeah, and the effectiveness of what we do. I mean, the section of what you just said, where you're talking about what the Evening Standard did, is just mind blowing. That, in, as you say, we consider ourselves an enlightened society, and something like that can happen. I mean, there's another whole topic we could go off onto there, which is there was a book by I don't know if you've heard of it, by a journalist called Will Black, who wrote a book called Psychopathic Cultures, where he determines that essentially, and in no mental health slur whatsoever, I hasten to add this point because it is a complex book, but that essentially that within corporate and government structures there are a few people who would be medically classed as psychopathic or sociopathic, and that their influence and their modus operandi and the way they conduct themselves then has a ripple effect on everyone else around them, and people will end up behaving in the same manner as this without even realising. It's a very complex sort of social psychology book, but that's it in layman's terms, and it's very true. We witness it all the time, and the Evening Standard story within what you said just sums that up. I want to move on to kind of concluding our chat, as it were, in the way that your album concluded, which was neoliberalism kills people, which is of course essentially what we've just been talking about.
You are beautiful no matter how this life disfigures you. You're beautiful even if that image you emulate isn't you. I don't know if history is linear or cyclical, but no, I'm ridiculed for making it.
The thing that stood out for me with that track, in one respect, there were many things that stood out, of course, but one of the things that stood out for me was that I felt like you were kind of a bit introspective on it, looking at where you'd been, where you kind of are now, looking at your views and in some respects how they've been shaped. It felt kind of very self-reflective in some elements of it, not all of it, but some portions of it seemed quite self-reflective. I mean, I always say, and I say it to countless people when I speak to them on the show, when I speak to people in real life on my estate, that the history will not view this decade kindly at all. This, when we'll see it in our lifetime, probably, that when we're pensioners, not that there'll be a pension for us to have, but when we're pensioners, the history books will be saying that this decade was probably one of the most horrendous in modern history for numerous reasons. And I don't think, in many ways, as a species, we're quite often not capable of seeing what is actually happening around us in a historical context, but I think it will be viewed like that. I mean, as I discussed sort of towards the start of this interview, you can see the growth of you as an artist, but also as a human, in numerous ways, from Soundtrack to the Struggle 1 in 2011 to this point now with the second album. I mean, how much has everything that has happened since 2011 up until this point, be it Grenfell, be it the sort of political shifting of sands, be it the ongoing carnage that the corporatist Western imperialism is meeting out in the Middle East, and that's now spreading into Africa. How much and how, I suppose is what I'm saying, how has that all shaped you as an artist now, and as a person as well, to get to Soundtrack to the Struggle 2? How what has it done to you, do you think? I know it's a really difficult question, sorry.
No, it's a great question, and I think that it's also, you know, we can't separate what's happened since 2011. I'm not saying you were trying to or you would, from the reverberations of 2003 and 2001 and what those things have actually meant. But there's I'm not sure if you are familiar with the late Mark Fisher. He developed ontology, and this idea of being in a constant state of anticipation for more just futures. And I think that to some extent it leaves you in that hinterland and that nether region between something horrific happening and trying to make it right, and it leaves you in kind of suspension because you can't allow yourself to move past this wrong that was committed. And I think a lot of my music is about trying to deal with those things and trying to rectify them through my music. So in the Letter to the 1%, I say, in the utopia of song, we are victorious, but the bittersweet reality is not this glorious. Because, you know, the music allows you a place to right those wrongs, but those wrongs are still dominating your existence. They are still determining the future and determining the future of the people you love. And so I think that that is what a lot of the music is about. It's about, you know, it's about hauntology. It's about being in that constant state of anticipation of a more just future and trying to, through music, bring that more just future into likelihood, really. And so I would say that, that song is also about that, but it's also, you can sense in it a kind of sense of disappointment, of feeling resentful, really, of a lot of things.
Yeah.
You know, and horror and trauma. I think I actually listened to the album really for the first time from beginning to end, like a week after it came out.
Okay.
And I just thought, my God, you know, this is really a person that needs therapy. This is a severely hurt human being. I mean, as we all are. I have to say, it would be a sign of severe, you know, to be well adjusted to injustice and this level of injustice, and the level of injustice would be pretty bad. You know, it would say something pretty terrible about your spirit. And so I think to some extent, potentially that sign of that kind of ill health in a way that is being communicated through the album and assigning the causes of that ill health to wider macro structures is an important thing. And that's really what it's about, I would say.
And I think you have fulfilled that task masterfully. I mean, just to backtrack slightly, I'm fascinated by the concept of being in a sort of heightened and constant state of anticipation. I've never considered that before. But it's actually really interesting because when you sort of really check it, people like us who are politically and socially switched on and engaged, it's like every day, isn't it, really, that you're constantly you're sort of marinating over something or angry about another thing or feeling forthright about something, and it's a constant, and there's no switching off. That's a fascinating concept, one that I hadn't considered before. I just sort of bowl through life dealing with sort of when it throws it at me, and I suppose that is exactly what I am, in a constant state of, as you say, and anticipation. But also what's fascinating is the way you summed up the album, because do you know what, I think that's why it has resonated already with so many people, because you are it does come across that it's kind of, as I mean, you put it, and I did laugh, but it's also a very serious point, kind of someone who needs therapy. Because, and that is probably how so many people are feeling. And I think the challenge we have as a society, like, is, of course, that of the people who are feeling like that, there is a certain portion who know why it is, and they know it's because of the system and because of what it's doing and has historically done to us. But then you have a portion of society of people who, whether they be people who are swinging to the likes of Tommy Robinson, whether they be kids who are knifing each other 100 yards from where I live, whoever it is, people who are in that state but don't understand why. And this is what your album has done so well, because as I said in the introduction, and as I've repeatedly said throughout it, you have bridged that gap between putting together a musical project which is accessible, which is so important youngers can listen to and hear and enjoy, but within that you have then put some of the most searing political and social messages of any artist. And I've interviewed and listened and spoken to a lot of artists recently, of any artist going at the minute, and it's an overarching, all-encompassing, just stunning piece of work in every respect. And I hope you are pleased with the end result, and I do hope that you're getting the credit you deserve, but you need to be getting more credit for it, because Soundtrack to the Struggle is a masterpiece. It's absolutely exceptional, and you should be very, very pleased with what you've
done. Thank you so much, Steve. And as someone that is, you know, absolutely on the front line of pushing for a society where wealth and economic and political power generally is redistributed, a better world, you know, someone that really knows their politics, someone that also really knows their music, it means a lot coming from you, you know, and I really appreciate that you sat down and thought about it and thought deeply about it. And I have to say also the fact that you provided me with regarding Twister and the Guinness Book of World Records and the syllables per second is amazing. I feel like I should even put that in some type of press release or in my CV, because that's amazing, man. That is an amazing thing.
You should. It's brilliant. It's great. I was doing it, and I was like, okay, so I took sort of one section, and I was like, right, okay, so that bit's 8 seconds. And I was like, oh, he does nine seconds here. He's like, I'm 9 seconds now. And then I got to his next one. I was like, I'm just going to double check this. And I was like, nope, that's about 10 syllables per second. It's my pleasure.
But also, Steve, you know, it's you know, and I'm sure you know this, you feel this too, is, you know, it's a thankless task, you know, what we're trying to do in different ways. But, you know, particularly what you do as well is something that when you're constantly providing, and I know you've recently, you know, changed things, but when you're constantly providing information, you're constantly working on challenging that elite narrative, and especially when you do it with the consistency that you've done it, it's almost like people begin to take that kind of presence for granted in a way. And so honestly, man, the work you do is fantastic, and we need it, and we need more of it. You know, if we had 10 of you, I think we'd be in a lot of a better situation than we are now. So, yeah, much respect to you, bro.
You're too kind. Thank you. We had one of our mates a few doors down came around the other day, and we were sort of chatting stuff with her. And sort of what you've just said, it's very easy for me, and I'm sure you're probably the same. Let me rephrase that, because what I'm about to say, you're not the same at all. I'm a dry alcoholic. I've been dry for nearly 3 years now, and when I gave up for the final time, it gives you a completely different perspective on life. And my overriding sort of mantra in life, Loki, is that I don't want to get to my dying breath and look back and think, you didn't really try hard enough, did you, to change things? I don't want to do that. So, and for me, that then answers everything, regardless of what people throw at you, regardless of whether people agree with you, regardless of whether you get any sort of credit for what you do. I know that I don't want to be leaving this plane knowing I could have done more. So, and it's fairly easy for me. And then, therefore, I just think, bowl on with everything. So,
yeah, 100%.
You're too kind anyway, what you said. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast again. Your tour is still ongoing, isn't it?
Yes,
and there's a few tickets left here and there. So check out Loki's Twitter, which is low with an O, isn't it? No, it's Loki, then with a zero online, not O online, zero online.
And also, Steve, I hope you'll be joining us on the 19th, if you're able to, in Hackney. It'll be great to have you.
That's very kind. We will. Thank you. It's really kind. Loki, for the minute, thank you so much, and best of luck with the rest of the tour.
Thank you, brother. Thank you.
I am in awe of Loki every time I have the privilege of speaking to him, one of the greatest thinkers and artists of our generation. He is such a star, and I love him very, very much. And here is one of my favourite tracks off Soundtrack to the Struggle 2. I think it's one of the most moving tracks on the album as well. It's absolutely fantastic, featuring the gorgeous vocals of Mai Khalil. This is Sunday Morning. Loki with Mai Khalil, Sunday Morning.
She lost her son on a Sunday, her memories are bloodstained. The paper showed his young face, who remembered his mum's name. She sleeps with the blanket he was wrapped in as a child. He's not dead, he's just napping for a while. She thinks backwards with a smile. On a clock, the hands stop, can't accept all the plans lost. Sunny Sundays dancing to Van Gogh's life. I used to be such a bad, bad boy, but I gave it up when I fell in love. Hold him close, breathe the smell of his skin, preserving every little thing. How can she ever begin to move on? Sunday mornings, getting the groove on. His little hands wave their newborn, grew strong through songs. She thinks he's coming in from school, made his favourite dinner too. Sitting talking to an empty chair in the living room. Roams the street calling out things that no one listened to. Tried to treat her but they thought solution was medicinal. No, and I don't think they'll ever comprehend it. Schizophrenic or a broken heart that can't be mended. Now she's sitting talking to herself where the bench is. Relatives wonder when she's coming to her senses. In her mind, he grew, walked a passage to a man. They branded it as madness, never planned to understand. She can't quite touch him, she imagines that she can. Holding the fabric to her face, squeezing the blanket in her hand, saying every Sunday morning, every Sunday morning, every Sunday morning, I dance with you. Came and took away his son was a Sunday, but he only woke up to the news on a Monday. More times he knows the situation ends one way, but he looks up searching for some hope in the sun rays. A year passed, 2 years passed, 3 years passed, finds it hard to get over the shadow.
And that's And that's it. This special episode of Top Line Caged is done. I'd like to thank this fantastic Loki. Follow him on Twitter. It's at Loki Online. As always, behind the scenes, thank you to the love of my life, the gorgeous Nicola Jeffrey. Follow her on Twitter. It's at Nicola C. Jeffrey. My man in the booth, sound engineer Gav Pause. Follow him on Twitter. It's at Pause with a Z Radio. Last but not least, thank you to my in-house singer. It's Ray Star Music. Follow her on Twitter. It's at Ray underscore Star 113. Thank you to the Canary for uncaging me. What a fantastic episode that was. See you next week.
Uncaged.